Hey guys, this right here is going to be an episode over everything hypertension. It includes the RAS system, target organ damage, disease, stuff like that. There's also some anatomy and physiology stuff that I left in this particular section because I understand that a lot of people are not CV strong and they do not like the CV system. And so I left that in there. That way, those particular individuals can have a little bit of an easier time following along with the material that's being presented. With the AI host, just be mindful of that hashtag tag thing that they do, or calling things weird. Like instead of saying inferior vena cava, they'll say like superior vena cava or inferior vena cava, stuff like that. Regardless, if you're able to get past that, the material is still very good and spot on, and it's great because it's coming straight from the textbook and the PowerPoints that accompany this particular textbook that the instructor has provided and uploaded to our learning system. So I hope that you guys enjoy the hypertension episode of the Lewis Medical Surgical Nursing 12th edition textbook.
Patients here.
Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, this is blood.
Well, he's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a tree, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
She's been 45 minutes
of CPR, no return to circulation. We can stop CPR. Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving deep into hypertension today. It's such a foundational condition, touches almost everything else in clinical practice. But it's so sneaky. We call it the silent killer.
Exactly. It's silent until it isn't.
So for our learner, the goal today is really to get past the basic summaries. We want that high yield sort of technical understanding. You need to really get a handle on the pathophysiology, the risks to the heart, and critically, how to manage it as a nurse.
It's such a crucial topic. Hypertension, it's still the number one modifiable risk factor for death globally. To manage it well, you really have to understand those internal feedback loops, the things driving that chronic high pressure. It's not just about knowing the numbers.
Right. So to make it real, let's start with a case. This is often how it happens, isn't it? The damage is well underway before anyone notices.
Yeah, classic presentation often.
Imagine a guy, 56 years old, seems active, works pretty stable overall, but he's missed his checkups for maybe 3 years.
Happens all the time.
And he doesn't come in with a headache. Not the classic sign people think of.
Right.
He comes in with this really profound fatigue, like crushing fatigue. He's dizzy, persistently dizzy. And the kicker, new onset shortness of breath when he exerts himself.
That dyspnea on exertion, that's the alarm bell.
Totally. He gets winded just climbing stairs, something he never had trouble with before.
So he gets checked out, and his BP is, well, it's through the roof. Pushing into that hypertensive crisis range, let's say what, 195 over 125, something like that.
Yeah, sky high. And the patient himself.
Yeah.
He's completely shocked, says he felt fine just a month ago.
Right. And that's the aha moment for the clinical team, isn't it? He's symptomatic because the pressure has finally started causing noticeable damage.
Exactly. He's likely developed target organ disease, that shortness of breath. Could be early heart failure, cardiac decompensation starting.
Yeah.
Or maybe the fatigue is his kidneys starting to feel the strain.
It's the scary part of this condition. He could have been walking around for years with that pressure, just hammering away at his blood vessels, completely unaware.
And now that he is symptomatic, it's not just stage two anymore. It's complicated hypertension.
So the big question becomes, how did his body sustain that level of pressure for so long without him noticing? The answer's really deep in the basic science, the plumbing, the pressure regulation.
Okay, so let's pull back the curtain then. Look at the plumbing, the cardiovascular structures, see what that pressure is actually doing. Hashtag tag 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 hashtag A. Basic cardiovascular structures and function.
Right. So the heart, it's this amazing four-chamber pump. You've got the protective sac, the pericardium, and then the layers. Endocardium inside, myocardium, the muscle, epicardium outside.
But the key difference for hypertension, as you said, is between the right and left sides, right?
Absolutely. Structurally, the left ventricular wall, the LV wall, is naturally way thicker, like 2 to 3 times thicker than the right ventricular wall.
And that difference tells you everything about the workload.
Exactly. The right ventricle, it just needs to push blood into the lungs, which is a pretty low resistance system. Easy job, relatively speaking.
But the left ventricle?
The left ventricle has to generate enough force to push blood out against the resistance of the entire body. That's the systemic vascular resistance, or SVR.
And in someone with uncontrolled hypertension, that SVR is constantly high.
Right. So the LV is essentially pumping against a brick wall constantly. That massively increases its workload.
Which leads directly to that thickening we talked about.
Yeah.
Left ventricular hypertrophy, LVH.
Yeah, and it's not just like building bigger biceps, you know. It's pathological.
Can you break down how that happens, the hypertrophy?
Sure. So initially, then the muscle cells thicken, but they push inward. It's called concentric hypertrophy. The heart's trying to adapt to that pressure overload.
Okay.
And for a while, that might actually increase how hard it contracts. But the really big problem is it makes the chamber stiff. It can't relax properly to fill with blood during diastole.
So that's the filling problem.
Exactly. That leads to what we call heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, HFPEF, super common with long-term hypertension. Eventually, though, that overworked muscle gets tired, fibrotic, less efficient. It starts to stretch out. That's eccentric hypertrophy. And then you get heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, HFREF.
And that whole process explains the shortness of breath in our case study guy. The left side just isn't pumping or filling effectively anymore.
Connects perfectly.
Okay, let's quickly trace the blood flow again just to nail down where that LV pressure fits in. So an oxygenated blood comes back, SVC-IVC.
Right. Atrium through the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle.
Then through the pulmonic valve, out the pulmonary artery to the lungs, gets oxygenated.
Comes back via the pulmonary veins into the left atrium, through the mitral valve, into that powerful left ventricle.
And then bam, through the aortic valve and out under all that pressure into the whole body.
That pressure is vital for getting blood everywhere, obviously. But when it's chronically high, it just starts breaking things down.
And think about the oxygen demand of that thickened LV muscle. The coronary arteries, especially the big ones like the LAD and the circumflex.
They have to work overtime to feed that massive muscle. And if those arteries start getting narrowed by plaque, well, that's a direct path to a heart attack, myocardial ischemia, #W. Understanding blood pressure dynamics. So blood pressure itself, it's just the force of the blood pushing against the artery walls. We need to be clear on the two numbers.
Systolic, the top number. Peak pressure when the ventricles squeeze. Normal is less than 120.
Right. And diastolic, the bottom number, that's the leftover pressure when the ventricles relax. Normal is less than 80.
Systolic often reflects how much blood is pumped out, stroke volume, and how elastic the arteries are. Diastolic may be a better clue about the resistance, the SVR.
Often, yes. And the fundamental equation that governs all this is BP equals COX SVR. Blood pressure equals cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance.
Cardiac output, that's how much blood the heart pumps per minute, usually driven by volume or heart rate.
Correct. But SVR, systemic vascular resistance, that's usually the main player in primary hypertension.
So SVR is the force fighting against blood flow, mostly determined by how wide or narrow those tiny little arterioles are and how stiff the arteries become.
Exactly. When we talk chronic hypertension, we're usually talking about chronically high SVR.
Okay, but what's the mechanism? What in the body is keeping that SVR cranked up all the time?
Now we get into the really important physiology, the stuff that links directly to how our medications work. You can't talk about sustained high SVR without talking about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, the RAAS.
Okay, the RAAS cascade. This is huge. It's the body's system for, like, emergency pressure correction, right? But it gets stuck on in chronic hypertension.
Precisely. It kicks off when the kidneys sense low blood flow or low volume. They release an enzyme called renin.
Okay, renin is the first step.
Renin then finds a protein made by the liver, angiotensinogen, and chops it into angiotensin I.
Angiotensin I. That's kind of the inactive precursor, right? It needs another step.
Correct. As angiotensin flows through the lungs, another enzyme, angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE, converts it into angiotensin II.
And angiotensin II, that's the molecule that causes all the trouble in hypertension.
It really is. It does two main things, both bad in the long run. First, it's an incredibly powerful vasoconstrictor. It clamps down on blood vessels hard, instantly increasing SVR and driving up BP.
Okay. Direct vasoconstriction. What's the second thing?
Second, it signals the adrenal glands sitting on top of the kidneys to release another hormone, Aldosterone.
Aldosterone. And that completes the loop, right? Makes it a vicious cycle.
Yes. Aldosterone tells the kidneys to hold on to sodium and water. More sodium in water means more volume in the bloodstream, which increases cardiac output.
So you've got angiotensin II squeezing the pipes, high SVR, and aldosterone adding more fluid to the system, high CO. Double whammy.
Exactly. And when this RAAS system stays activated long term, maybe due to chronic stress, genetics, kidney issues, you get stuck with that sustained high pressure. That's why drugs targeting RAAS are so effective. ACE inhibitors block the ACE enzyme.
So you don't make as much angiotensin II.
Right. And ARBs, angiotensin receptor blockers, they block angiotensin II from binding to its receptors so it can't cause vasoconstriction or trigger aldosterone release.
That really clarifies the why behind those drug classes. It's not just RAAS, though, is it? There are other players.
Oh, yeah, it's complex. You have things like endothelin, another strong vasoconstrictor released when the blood vessel lining gets damaged. But you also have counterplayers like natriuretic peptides, hormones released by the heart itself that try to lower BP by getting rid of sodium. It's a constant battle. #TouchDC. Classification, risk, and pathophysiology of primary HTN.
Okay, so we understand the pressure mechanisms better. Let's talk about classifying it. The current guidelines for adults, over 18. And we need to stress, right, it's based on the higher number, systolic or diastolic, and needs at least two accurate readings on separate visits.
Crucial points. So, normal, less than 120 systolic AND, less than 80 diastolic. Then elevated, 120 to 129 systolic AND, still less than 80 diastolic.
Okay.
That's stage one hypertension. 130 to 139 systolic or R, 80 to 89 diastolic. And stage two hypertension. 140 or higher, systolic or 90, or higher diastolic.
Got it. And it's worth noting, systolic tends to creep up with age as arteries stiffen, while diastolic might peak around middle age and then level off or even drop a bit.
True. So you always treat based on whichever category is higher. Now, we know most cases, 90-95%, are primary or essential hypertension, meaning no single clear cause we can point to, unlike secondary HTN, which has an underlying condition.
But even within primary HTN, there's that huge factor we need to discuss. The genetics of salt sensitivity.
Yes, back to water and sodium. High sodium intake is definitely a risk factor, but here's the pearl. Only about 1 in 3 people who eat a lot of salt actually develop hypertension.
So it's not just the salt intake itself?
No, it seems to depend heavily on your genetics, whether you're salt sensitive or salt resistant.
That's a really actionable piece of information for teaching patients.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know which groups tend to be more salt sensitive?
We do. The evidence points strongly towards Black individuals, middle-aged adults, and older adults being more likely to be salt sensitive.
Okay.
So for these folks, cutting back on sodium isn't just good advice. It can have a really dramatic effect on their BP. It really underscores why treatment needs to be individualized.
Absolutely. And then there's that long list of other risk factors for primary HTN. The modifiable ones are where we focus prevention efforts, right? Smoking, too much alcohol, diabetes, high cholesterol, being overweight, not moving enough, stress, high sodium.
Right. But we can't ignore the non-modifiable ones either. Age, gender, men slightly higher risk until about 64. Then women catch up, or past family history, ethnicity. They all play a role.
Our guy in the case study, 56-year-old man, maybe a family history of stroke.
Yeah.
He hits several of those risk categories.
Exactly. Often you see those modifiable risks piled on top of the non-modifiable ones. That's the profile that really needs aggressive screening and management.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Focus on the 20-80 rule idea. What's the 20% of knowledge or intervention that gives us 80% of the benefit in preventing complications? Lifestyle's got to be number one. #HS. The 7 simple keys to prevention.
Definitely. And the American Heart Association's Life's Simple 7 is such a great framework for this. Easy to teach, easy for patients to grasp.
Okay, let's run through them. Number 1, manage blood pressure itself. Obvious starting point.
2, control cholesterol. Usually diet first, then maybe statins.
3, reduce blood sugar. Huge connection there, right? High sugar just wrecks blood vessels, making hypertension and its complications way worse.
Absolutely. 4, get active. Regular exercise helps lower SVR naturally.
5, eat better. And this is where the DHH diet comes in. Dietary approaches to stop hypertension.
Yes. Lots of fruits, veggies, low-fat dairy, cut back on saturated fat, total fat, and critically, cut back on sodium. It works, even without meds sometimes.
Okay. 6, lose weight if needed. And 7, stop smoking. Avoid all tobacco. Nicotine's a potent vasoconstrictor, spikes that SVR.
So here's where it gets really critical, understanding why managing those things matters so much, the complications.
This is the high-yield takeaway, right? Hypertension is the silent killer, because symptoms usually only show up after target organ disease has started. We need to know the big five target organs.
Exactly. First, the heart. We already talked about LVH leading to heart failure, plus that constant pressure damages the coronary arteries, speeds up atherosclerosis, leading to heart attack, MI.
Okay, heart first. Second.
The brain. Hypertension is the most important risk factor for stroke, both ischemic, caused by clots, and hemorrhagic, caused by bleeds.
Third.
The kidneys. Those tiny filters in the kidneys, the glomeruli and arterioles, they just get hammered by high pressure. Leads to chronic kidney disease, sometimes even kidney failure requiring dialysis.
And how do we pick that up early?
Early signs include protein spilling into the urine, specifically microalbuminuria. That's why a routine urinalysis and checking kidney function tests like BUN and creatinine on a BMP are standard for anyone with hypertension.
Okay, heart, brain, kidneys. Fourth.
The eyes. High pressure damages the tiny blood vessels in the retina, causing retinopathy. You can see hemorrhages, leaky spots called exudates, even swelling of the optic nerve head, papilledema.
Wow, so an eye exam can literally show the effects of high blood pressure elsewhere.
It's a window into the systemic vascular health. And fifth, the peripheral vascular system. High pressure damages arteries everywhere, leading to peripheral vascular disease, PVD. Causes leg pain with walking, claudication, poor wound healing, increases amputation risk.
So those five. Heart, brain, kidneys, eyes, peripheral vessels. That's our checklist when assessing someone with longstanding or severe hypertension. #C, the CAD connection.
Let's zoom in a bit more on coronary artery disease, CAD, because it's probably the most common serious outcome. It all starts with atherosclerosis.
Hardening of the arteries, ASHD. The high pressure itself damages the inner lining of the artery, the endothelium.
Exactly, creates little injuries. And those injured spots are where fatty plaques love to deposit and build up.
So the pipe gets narrower, and then that already overworked, hypertrophied left ventricle needs more oxygen.
But the narrowed coronary artery can't deliver enough. The supply doesn't meet the demand. That results in myocardial ischemia. The heart muscle is starved for oxygen, and that often manifests as angina, chest pain.
Okay, angina. But there are different types.
Right. There's chronic stable angina. This is predictable. It comes on with a certain amount of exertion or stress, feels the same each time, and reliably goes away with rest or a quick-acting nitrate like sublingual nitroglycerin. The ECG changes, like ST depression, are temporary.
Okay, stable angina. But then there's the really dangerous one, the one we really need to emphasize.
Silent ischemia. This is the one that should keep us up at night. It's actual myocardial ischemia. Heart muscle is being damaged or dying, but the patient feels nothing. No chest pain, no symptoms at all.
That's terrifying. Who's most at risk for that?
It's particularly common in patients with diabetes, especially if they have diabetic neuropathy. The nerve damage from diabetes can affect the nerves that would normally transmit heart pain signals.
So they could be having ischemia and not even know it. How do we catch it?
Only through objective testing. An ECG might show changes like ST depression or T wave inversion, even while the patient says they feel fine, or stress testing might reveal it.
Wow. And the risk is just as high as symptomatic angina.
Absolutely. Silent ischemia carries the same risk of heart attack and death. This is why proactive screening, especially ECGs, is so vital for high-risk patients, particularly diabetics with hypertension. We can't wait for symptoms that might never come.
Okay, this brings us squarely into the nurse's role, managing hypertension day to day, helping patients achieve and maintain that goal, BP. It all starts with getting the measurement right. Precision assessment.
Accuracy is everything. You know, some studies suggest that a significant portion of what looks like resistant hypertension is actually just due to improper BP measurement technique.
That's huge. So we have to be the experts and teach patients how to do it right at home, too.
Absolutely. So the prep.
Yeah.
No smoking, exercise, or caffeine for at least 30 minutes beforehand. That's key.
Okay. And positioning.
Have the patient sit quietly, feet flat on the floor, back supported for at least 5 minutes. Relax. No talking during the measurement.
Critically important, that no talking part. And the arm.
Arm should be supported, roughly at heart level, and you must use the right cuff size. Too small gives a falsely high reading. Too large gives a falsely low one.
Right. Then the technique itself.
Deflate the cuff slowly, about 2 to 3 millimeters of mercury per second. Listen carefully for those carotid cough sounds.
And you always check both arms initially, right?
Yes. There can be a difference. Find the arm with the consistently higher reading and use that arm for all future monitoring. Document which arm you're using.
And don't forget infection control. Clean the cuff between patients according to policy. Seems small, but it matters.
Absolutely. Now, beyond the standard BP, we also need to assess for orthostatic hypotension, especially when starting or changing antihypertensive meds.
Because those meds can sometimes drop the pressure too much, especially when they stand up. Big fall risk.
Exactly. So the procedure is pretty standard. Measure BP and heart rate after they've been lying flat supine for about 5 minutes.
Okay, baseline supine.
Help them stand up fairly quickly but safely. Then measure the BP and heart rate again after 1 minute of standing and again at 3 minutes of standing.
And what are we looking for? What defines an abnormal or positive orthostatic result?
We call it positive if the systolic BP drops by 20 points or more, or if the diastolic BP drops by 10 points or more, or if the heart rate increases by 20 beats per minute or more.
Any one of those three counts.
Any one of those. If you see that, the patient has orthostatic hypotension. They need immediate teaching about changing positions, slowly dangling feet before standing, rising slowly.
Good. Now, beyond the numbers, we need to be good detectives with subjective data, asking the right questions based on those functional health patterns.
Right, like asking about nocturia having to get up multiple times at night to pee. That could signal fluid overload, maybe early kidney issues, or even heart failure.
And definitely asking about fatigue or dyspnea on exertion, like our case study patient. That screams potential heart failure progression.
And we have to be comfortable asking the sensitive questions too, under the sexual reproductive pattern. Asking about erectile dysfunction or decreased libido. #B. Management of medication side effects and adherence.
Yeah, that sensitive topic. It leads right into probably the biggest challenge in long-term management. Adherence. Getting patients to stick with the plan.
It's a huge problem. People stop meds because they feel fine once their BP is controlled or the cost is too high. Maybe they don't fully understand why they need it.
Or very commonly because of side effects they don't like.
Exactly. So we have to anticipate and teach about common side effects based on the drug class. For instance, ACE inhibitors, the Iprals, like lisinopril. What are the two big ones?
That persistent dry hacking cough and the rare but serious one, angioedema, the swelling.
Right. And the cough, why does that happen?
It's because ACE inhibitors block the breakdown of bradykinin, right? So bradykinin builds up and irritates the airways.
Perfect. So the nursing intervention is crucial. Tell the patient if that cough is driving them crazy, they need to tell their provider. They can often be switched to an ARB, an angiotensin receptor blocker, the sartans.
Because ARBs work differently, they don't cause the bradykinin buildup.
Exactly. Okay, what about calcium channel blockers, CCBs, like amlodipine? They work mainly by relaxing blood vessels, lowering SVR.
The common side effect there is peripheral edema, right? Especially ankle swelling.
Yes, that vasodilation can cause fluid to leak out a bit in the lower legs. Usually, we reassure the patient, suggest elevating their legs. If it's really bad, the dose or drug might need changing.
And diuretics, like HCTZ or furosemide.
Main things there are volume loss and electrolyte shifts. We watch potassium closely, risk of low potassium with thiazides and loops, unless they're on a potassium-sparing one like spironolactone, then the risk is high potassium.
Okay, electrolytes are key. And the practical side effect.
Frequent voiding can be annoying, especially at night. The simple teaching point, take the diuretic early in the day, ideally morning, so it doesn't keep them up all night running to the bathroom.
Smart. And circling back to the sexual problems, reduced libido, ED, often linked to beta blockers, but others too. We can't shy away from this.
You really can't. We need to ask about it sensitively. If a medication is causing problems in that area, the patient will stop taking it, even if they don't tell you. The treatment plan has to work for their whole life, not just their blood pressure reading. We might need to advocate for a different medication.
So strategies to boost compliance. Individualize the plan, definitely. Get caregivers involved if appropriate. Try to find affordable options, maybe combination pills, to reduce the number of tablets they take each day.
And constant patient teaching. Remind them, don't double up if you miss a dose, don't just skip doses, and never stop antihypertensives abruptly. That can cause dangerous rebound hypertension.
It's a lifelong partnership, really. #TaxTaxTaxTaxC.
Okay, last big area. Managing the extreme end, the hypertensive crisis. That's when the SBP is over 180 or the DVP is over 120. Need to act fast, but differentiate correctly.
Right. There's urgency versus emergency. How do we tell the difference?
It all comes down to target organ damage. Hypertensive urgency is that really high BP, but crucially, there's no evidence of acute damage to the heart, brain, kidneys, etc.
Okay, so really high numbers, but the organs seem okay for now. How do we manage urgency?
Usually doesn't require hospitalization. The goal is gradual BP reduction over 24 to 48 hours, typically using oral meds like captopril, labetalol, clonidine. Follow-up is key.
Got it. Now the scary one, hypertensive emergency.
That's the critical situation. Oh, okay. Same high BP numbers, but with evidence of acute ongoing target organ damage. Things like hypertensive encephalopathy, confusion, seizures, acute heart attack, acute heart failure with pulmonary edema, stroke, or acute kidney failure.
This is life-threatening. Requires immediate hospitalization, likely ICU.
Absolutely. The goal here is rapid but controlled BP reduction using IV medications. We usually aim to lower the mean arterial pressure, the MAP, by no more than about 20-25% in the first hour, or get the MAP down to around 110 to 115 millimeter HG.
Why not drop it faster? If it's 221 to 30, why not aim for normal right away?
Because the brain and kidneys have likely adapted their blood flow regulation, their autoregulation, to that chronically high pressure. If you drop the pressure too quickly, you can actually cause underperfusion to those vital organs, leading to ischemic stroke or acute kidney injury. It has to be carefully controlled.
So slow and steady, relatively speaking, what kind of IV drugs do we use?
Potent, easily titratable ones. Vasodilators like sodium nitroprusside are common. Also IV labetalol and icatibant, drugs we can adjust minute by minute.
And the absolutely critical nursing responsibility when titrating these potent IV drips.
Constant vigilance. Because these drugs act so fast, you need to monitor heart rate and blood pressure literally every 2 to 3 minutes initially. Then maybe every 5-15 minutes as things stabilize.
Wow, every 2-3 minutes. That's intense monitoring.
It has to be. Continuous cardiac monitoring, ECG, is essential. Frequent neurochecks looking for changes in alertness, orientation, signs of stroke. Strict bed rest, usually. Monitoring urine output closely for kidney function. It's high-intensity care. Hashtag, tag, 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 VO. Closing recap and provocative thought.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. From the basic plumbing and the RAA system driving the pressure to the devastating target organ damage and the nitty-gritty of assessment and management. The big picture is managing hypertension isn't just about a number. It's about stopping that relentless damage.
Exactly. The goal is always twofold. Get the BP to goal, yes, but also reduce those cardiovascular risk factors and prevent or slow down target organ disease.
So if you're heading to the clinical setting right now, what are the two absolute must-remember high-yield points from today?
I'd say number one, accuracy. Be obsessed with accurate BP measurement. Know the steps. Use the right cuff. Teach your patients properly. Bad data leads to bad decisions.
Couldn't agree more. Accuracy first. What's number two?
Number two has to be adherence. Recognize it's the biggest hurdle. Proactively address side effects, especially the sensitive ones like sexual dysfunction. Offer practical tips for orthostatics or diuretic timing. Reinforce those lifestyle changes, DAH, sodium, activity. Management is lifelong. Compliance is key.
Great takeaways. And we should touch on the geriatric challenge one last time. Older adults, huge risk, right? 90% lifetime risk over 55.
Huge risk. And they often have isolated systolic hypertension, more issues with orthostatic hypotension, and are really sensitive to drug side effects and interactions.
And that specific warning about common NSAIDs.
Yes, needs repeating. Over-the-counter pain meds like ibuprofen or naproxen can seriously interfere with BP control.
Yeah.
They can cause sodium and water retention, blunt the effect of many antihypertensives, and even trigger heart failure, especially if the patient is also on an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. Critical teaching point.
Definitely. So thinking back to our opening case and that concept of silent ischemia, it leaves us with a provocative thought, doesn't it?
It does. If the body adapts to high pressure and symptoms like shortness of breath only show up late when damage is done, and if serious heart disease like CAD can be completely silent, how far should we be pushing routine screening?
You mean beyond just BP checks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we be doing baseline ECGs more routinely? Maybe screening echocardiograms, looking for that LVH, checking for microalbuminuria earlier and more often? How aggressive do we need to be with objective tests to find the silent killer before it causes a catastrophe like in our patient?
That's a really important question for clinical practice and guidelines moving forward. If the killer is silent, our surveillance probably needs to be louder.
Well put.
Thank you. This has been an incredibly valuable deep dive into mastering hypertension. Hopefully everyone listening feels better equipped to tackle this at the bedside.